Welcome to Beekeeping Today Podcast, presented by Bee Culture. Beekeeping Today Podcast is your source for beekeeping news, information, and entertainment. I'm Jeff Ott.
And I'm Kim Flatham.
Hey, Jeff and Kim. Today's sponsor is Global Patties. They're a family-operated business that manufactures protein supplement patties for honeybees. It's a good time to think about honeybee nutrition. Feeding your hive's protein supplement patties will ensure that they produce strong and healthy colonies by increasing brood production and overall honey flow. Now is a great time to consider what type of patty is right for your area and your honeybees. Global offers a variety of standard patties as well as custom patties to meet your needs. No matter where you are, Global is ready to serve you out of their manufacturing plants in Airdrie, Alberta, and in Butte, Montana, or from distribution depots across the continent. Visit them today at www.globalpatties.com.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sherry. We really appreciate our sponsor support. They help make all of this happen and provide us the ability to expand and grow, as you'll see in the coming weeks. With that, thanks to Bee Culture Magazine for continuing their presenting sponsorship of this podcast. Bee Culture has been the magazine for American beekeeping since 1873. Subscribe to Bee Culture today. And while you're there, check out Bee Culture's Beekeeping Your First 3 Years, a quarterly magazine for beginning beekeepers. We also want to thank 2 Million Blossoms as sponsor of this episode. 2 Million Blossoms is a quarterly magazine dedicated to protecting all pollinators. Learn more in our Season 2, Episode 9 podcast with editor and our occasional guest co-host, Kirsten Trainer, and from visiting www.2millionblossoms.com, and that is with the number 2. Hey, everybody, thanks a lot for joining us again. We're really glad you're here because we have another big episode for you, but more of that in a minute. Hey, Kim, how are you doing? Are you got your snowshoes strapped on?
Yeah, I'm afraid so, and it looks like we're going to get some more, but there's enough out there to track a cat, but that's about it.
Track a cat. When you need to do it, you need to do it. That's all there can be said.
Yep, better than shoveling.
That's true. That is true. Hey, so we have a couple big things coming on right now. The first is our brand new shiny website that we just released to the world last week.
I've been there, Jeff. It looks good. There's a lot of it. There's a lot more information there, and ways to get information, ways to leave messages. I haven't tried it, but it looks like I can phone in and leave you a voicemail.
Well, yeah, it's not even phoning in. You can just click on the little microphone at the bottom right-hand corner of the screen, and you can leave a voicemail message. So that's pretty kind of cool. So we're looking at ways that we can use that in our podcast, so people can leave questions and comments, and then we can play those back. And maybe get some of our listeners to be an active participant in the podcast as well.
Oh, I'll take it another step, Jeff. I wonder if we could do it during a podcast.
I think that's beyond our technical capabilities at the moment.
Okay.
But that's you know, we've talked about that in the past, is kind of doing a live podcast at the same time, or like a YouTube or something like that. But that's on our future list.
I'm writing it down.
Futures. But don't put a date on it yet. And you and Jim have been working on a new podcast, or a second podcast.
Yeah, Honey Bee Obscura is the name of it. And we've got 5 of them in the can. We're getting ready to get them edited and get them set out here. Sometime in January, I think, is what the schedule calls for.
Yeah, we're looking at second half of January, probably.
Yeah. And it's just all about bees and beekeeping and beekeepers. That's all it is. It's just two guys chatting about whatever comes to mind that day, basically.
Well, it's more than just a couple of guys, right? I mean, you guys are accomplished beekeepers and knowledgeable experts in the field. So I think the listeners will come away with, at the end of each episode, come out with some useful and usable information. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we hope that's... That's the goal. That's the goal.
Excellent. And Kirsten Trainer with 2 Million Blossoms is also working on a new podcast, and we'll be spinning off her occasional episodes into a regular podcast where she can focus more on the whole pollinator realm, and not just honeybees. And that'll be exciting and provide exposure for a whole new podcast audience, too, that likes the butterflies and the flying bats and all the other pollinators in the world.
Yeah, she's good with honeybees, but this is her specialty, and I think it should be good.
Yeah, looking forward to it. So I encourage everyone to kind of keep an eye out on our podcast and our website for the announcement of Honeybee Obscura and the 2 Million Blossoms, the podcast. Both of those will be coming out in January. And go to our new website. Leave us a note. We'd love to hear from you.
And what's that website again?
www.beekeepingtodaypodcast.com.
Okay.
You know, planning for disaster is very important in today's world.
Yeah, you can't be too ready. And unfortunately, way too often we're fixing instead of preventing.
Yeah. And today's guests are experts in this for the honeybees, Peter Armitage and David Peck.
Yeah, they got this action plan now. I gotta tell you this, Jeff. They're working up in Canada, and they're working on Newfoundland Island, and it's pronounced Newfoundland. Understand Newfoundland, because we way too often slur it and we go Newfoundland. And if you live there, it's Newfoundland. So remember that when you're talking to them.
So and Newfoundland, right? Newfoundland is there. I am just messing it up. Newfoundland is far eastern Canada. Is that correct?
It's eastern. If you look at a map and you're looking at North America, Canada, and the U.S., and you look way off to the east, and on the eastern edge of Canada, you'll see a bunch of islands, and then you look up, because the Newfoundland is north of that bunch of islands, but that's where it is, off the east coast of Canada.
Pretty rugged terrain there.
Yes. I would not want to try and keep bees there, I don't think.
So we're going to be talking to them in just a few seconds about their Varroa action plan. They're Varroa free right now, and they're getting set to combat Varroa should they show up.
Yep.
All right. Well, before our visit with Peter and David, let's hear from our friends at Strong Microbials.
Hello, beekeepers. Your honeybees face a lot of challenges out there. Unbalanced food sources from monoculture crops, holding yards, drought, food shortages, antibiotics, pesticides, and pathogens like chalk brood. To overcome these challenges, your bees need the multiple bacteria that are in all nectars, pollens, and the environment. These bacteria aid honeybees' digestion and improve your honeybees' response and resilience to pesticides. Now you can help improve your honey colony health with a quick, easy, and safe-to-use product. Strong Microbials Super DFM Honeybee uses naturally occurring bacteria to restore the healthy gut biome of your honeybees. Check them out today at www.strongmicrobials.com.
Hey, welcome, Peter. Welcome, David, to Beekeeping Today podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
Jeff, I'm kind of looking forward to this because I just don't know a whole lot about the part of Canada we're going to talk about today. I've never been there, and this is the first person I've ever met from there, so I'm gonna learn a lot today.
Yeah, I can probably point out Newfoundland on a map. I can barely say it, so it's this is really going to be interesting. Peter, thanks for joining.
We try to help come from aways, or mainlanders as they are called, with the pronunciation by saying, understand Newfoundland, understand Newfoundland.
That works.
Why didn't we go over this before we started recording? All right, go ahead.
I think the best thing to understand is, Jeff, is the fact that they don't have Varroa up there.
Yes.
And what we're going to find out about today is how and why and what they're going to do to make sure it stays that way.
David, by the way, David is used to explaining where Newfoundland is to his neighbors there in New York State. David, how do you do it?
Yeah, well, I too didn't really know anything about Newfoundland except that there weren't any Varroa mites there. And so the way I explain it is everybody's got a decent picture of America in their head, or at least every American does. And then you can imagine Canada on top of that, and you know that on the eastern side there's some islands. And so Newfoundland is the island that you aren't picturing. It's the one you've forgotten that's a little further east and a little further north than all the rest of them. and whether or not most Americans know it, there are people there, and some of them are beekeepers, and those bees don't have varroa mites.
Well, wonderful. That brings up a point, David. You're in Ithaca, New York at Cornell, and what's your relationship with the situation up there?
Sure. So my training as a PhD was in the lab of Tom Seeley. I'm his last minted PhD student before he retired from teaching. But I'm currently still working at Cornell as a postdoctoral associate in the Department of Entomology. And I'm currently the co-instructor of Cornell's honeybee biology course. But my connection to the Newfoundland project happened really through Peter, who contacted me about some research that I had published, and that got us to talking. But throughout my career studying varroa transmission and varroa resistance behavior by honeybees, I've persistently, you know, been fascinated by this idea that, you know, while I'm writing a paper, I would occasionally have to say varroa is a ubiquitous parasite. It's found on all honeybee populations around the world, except, and then I would list the excepts. And Newfoundland has always been on that list, and that list has shrunk even in my short time as a honeybee scientist. And so the idea that I would be able to jump onto a project and start contributing to keeping Newfoundland a varroa-free location seemed certainly worth my time as a varroa scientist.
Well, that makes perfect sense, I guess. So, Peter, you've got what got our attention here was a varroa action plan that you've put together up there. And I guess between the two of you, can you kind of just outline it briefly of what the plan is? And then we can look at some of the aspects of it.
Well, I'll just introduce the varroa action plan briefly, just talk about its genesis. After I made contact with David there in 2018, I tabled some resolutions with our beekeeping association, our provincial beekeeping association, to adopt the varroa action plan. And then myself and David and a retired fisheries biologist here by the name of Dr. Steve Walsh, we set to work and did the research for the plan. And David came here in the summer of 2018 for two workshops to meet with beekeepers and to talk about some of our ideas for such a plan. And then we just released it to the public and to our provincial government in September, and it's also gone out to peer review. So I'll pass the torch to you, David, to give us an outline about the report itself.
Sure. So the plan, as which is very much a living document that is evolving as we get additional information, can be maybe arguably broken down into three components. It's a plan whose goal is to keep varroa out of Newfoundland, and the strategies that we suggest adopting are a combination of education, educating beekeepers, educating people who might encounter a rogue swarm of bees that could be varroa infested, surveillance, and we've got a number of different surveillance strategies that we outline in the plan itself, and then preparing to respond to a varroa incursion. And so that's preparing beekeepers, it's preparing the government, and it's even preparing the bees genetically, potentially. So those three components, education, surveillance, and preparing to respond, are the various prongs that we're trying to recommend be implemented to keep varroa off of the island and out of the province.
Well, you know, since we've been putting up with varroa for over 30 years down here, I think we've got a fairly good handle on how bad it really is. So the part that I find most interesting is the surveillance part. What kinds of actions are you taking to make sure that if it comes into Newfoundland, you'll find it?
Well, the really obvious surveillance is that if you know that bees are coming onto Newfoundland, you want to make sure that you check them for varroa mites. And you can do any of a number of different varroa tests, and you want to be thorough to make sure they aren't there. The easier option than that is to just not allow any new bees to be brought onto the island. And that's basically what has already been adopted by the provincial government and the Canadian federal government, is that it's very difficult to get a new honeybee onto the island. And they have to come from a certified varroa-free location.
Where would that be?
Western Australia currently is a place where we have had had importation. We have also imported eggs from other parts of Canada for the purpose of improving varroa resistance in our stock. But we think that the highest risk for a varroa incursion here is illegal importation, followed by a port of entry. We noted that the Australians had identified a port of entry as their highest risk for a varroa incursion. But we would probably give illegal importation a higher risk rating. So one of the ways that we would try to intercept this is with a sentinel apiary program, whereby we would have beekeepers at strategic locations across the province test regularly using best practice methods. I'll let David speak a little bit more about that. And then we would also follow the example of the New Zealanders with a passive surveillance program, which includes training as many beekeepers as possible in the province to test routinely for varroa, say using alcohol wash, or if they really don't want to kill bees, the sugar shake method. David, do you want to add to that?
Well, I will just point out that in addition to these active surveillance and passive surveillance methods, because we think that one of the largest risks to the island's bee population of a varroa incursion is someone ignorantly importing bees from off of the island, the education that we're trying to get out to the beekeepers and also to would-be beekeepers or to the family members of beekeepers is incredibly important, because if you decide you're going to import a bee colony from your buddy in a different province, then we're relying on your aunt to have seen some announcement on Facebook that if you know somebody getting bees, they better be getting them from a clean source somewhere in the province. So the education component, is really a part of the surveillance, and really all of the different parts of the plan interact with each other in that way, is that you have to take this holistic, multi-pronged approach simultaneously, because if you just focus on one strategy, looking for new mites coming in, then not educating potential beekeepers, you've set yourself up for failure.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah.
Do the postal and parcel delivery service, are they aware of the restriction?
That is part of the plan. Part of the plan would be, say, on a yearly basis to have good contact with the Canadian Postal Service as well as the commercial courier companies, mm-hmm. to remind them that it is illegal to import bees into the province. And so if they were to receive a shipment of bees in the mail, we'll say, they would phone the police and the provincial authorities in the same way that they would if they suspected that the shipment contained drugs or explosives or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we have covered that possibility in our plan.
And just looking at the map of Newfoundland and the Gulf of St. Lawrence there, how narrow is the narrowest part of that, the water gap that you have there?
The shortest distance to the mainland of Canada is about, I'll put this in miles, we'll say 20 miles between the northern tip of Newfoundland and Labrador. But there are no bees currently on the other side there. It's a subarctic kind of landscape, and it's not a place to keep bees there. So we're more likely to get bees brought in either, by a postal route, a package from anywhere, mm-hmm. or somebody brings them into the province in the back of a pickup truck from the province to the south of us, which is Nova Scotia. And that's a 6.5-hour ferry ride. We're very lucky to have been surrounded by this giant moat. And so it's pretty difficult for bees to drift that distance. And the situation is a little different from what happened in 1989 when varroa first arrived in Canada, because there, that long border between our two countries cannot prevent the bees from, swarming and drifting across the long border. So there were incursions into Canada in 1989 and in the early 80s from multiple points across that border.
Well, with a gap that size, you're pretty safe from the errant swarm or a drifting bee, I would guess. So if varroa is going to show up on your island, somebody had to bring it there.
Absolutely. So, it's going to take a lot of help from humans to bring those varroas over here, those varroa mites. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned sentinel apiaries, and you've got those like Australia does in your ports, I know. Australia monitors those fairly rigorously. What else, what other facets do you have going on? Let's say something came in a boat and it didn't bother to stop at your sentinel apiary, it just leapfrogged right over and kept going.
Well, one really important component of the plan is the implementation of what we call bee districts, where we've actually drawn lines in the sand across the island of Newfoundland and separating the mainland portion of Labrador in the province. And so by drawing these lines, any bee that sneaks in accidentally or unintentionally to, let's say, the port of St. John's on the eastern side of the island might be able to spread between colonies in that region, but they're not going to be able to cross the bee district line as long as the beekeepers comply with the test before you cross the line policy that we're recommending. And so the benefit is that by dividing this island and its bee population into a few different regions, even if we have an incursion in one, we could fight it back there or even eliminate the bees there and then repopulate using the clean varroa-free stock in other regions.
So how do bees see this line?
Well, the nice thing about Newfoundland is that it's very difficult for a wild swarm or a feral swarm to take off and find a tree to live in. The trees are not very big. The climate is not very forgiving. There's not really enough pollen for a rogue swarm to go off and build wax, fill it up with honey, and then last through the winter without some assistance. So unlike many places in the world where the best efforts of beekeepers are thwarted by swarms, picking up diseases and then spreading them around, Newfoundland is pretty well able to avoid that. So if we know where the beekeepers all are, and another component of the plan is mandatory registration of apiaries with the provincial apiarist, if we know where the beekeepers are and the beekeepers know that they shouldn't be crossing that line, we don't have to worry too much about the bees making the flights themselves.
Yeah, I guess it sounds like a tough place to keep bees. Overall.
Yeah, I would put it on a sort of marginal side of the beekeeping spectrum, and there's not a lot of agriculture here in the province as well. There are vast expanses of black spruce, boreal forest, and marshlands where there's little of interest to honeybees, but there are still many areas in the province where you can keep bees. And I would say we're still in a kind of an experimental phase trying to determine what kind of an industry we can develop here. I note that in 2010, there were only 6 beekeepers in the entire province with less than 220 colonies. And now with all of the modern day interest in saving bees and backyard homesteading and so on, we've grown rapidly to over 130 beekeepers. So it's that rapid expansion in the craft, and with 10 or more people wanting to try and make a living from beekeeping, that we think that the risk of a varroa incursion is far greater than it used to be a dozen years ago.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Wow. And most of these people are fairly new and have no experience with looking for varroa. You could have it and not know it, definitely. So I would guess your education program is exactly that. At the forefront is, what is it? What does it do? And how do I spot it? Right, and the tests that you're giving.
Well, and I would think also, and the challenge would be if they do get a foothold in the country, it'd be hard for some people to want to treat for them. I would imagine if there's a lot of homesteading. Maybe I'm generalizing too much, but I think there would be a resistance to any chemical treatments for the varroa.
And that's even something that we've dealt with in the development of the plan, because one thing we've suggested is for certain members of the Sentinel program, it would be really advantageous if instead of having to take a sticky board, put a screened bottom board underneath your hive, stick the sticky board in, and then wait a few days or a week to see whether a mite falls, it'd be much more convenient to go out and apply some kind of varroa treatment to knock down any theoretically present mites as quickly as possible.
Right.
But we've already seen some pushback to those ideas about which chemicals are people comfortable putting in their hives, given that we know that there are issues with residue, there are issues with toxicity, and we know that the mites aren't even here. And so bringing in the, all of those downsides of varroa treatment and not even having the mites is a pretty big ask for a small-scale beekeeper who may still want to participate in the Sentinel program.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Wow. So you've got a good, it sounds like you've got a pretty good plan. Is it already in place? Is it already set up? People, you got your lines in the sand and your Sentinel apiaries and things going already?
We discussed many of the most important elements of the plan at the two Varroa Action Plan workshops that David participated in, where he was a major presenter in August 2019. So now we've released the plan last month, and we are waiting for a response from the provincial government. There's a fair bit of homework for our government to attend to in terms of developing a crisis response. We need some changes to our Animal Health and Protection Act to give us better tools to defend against varroa as well as other pests and pathogens. And then we really need to recruit people to participate in a volunteer Sentinel apiary program. And we need to train our beekeepers in the basic elements of monitoring, testing, using screen bottom boards with sticky boards, alcohol wash, and so on. As you pointed out, because we are so varroa naive here, our beekeepers don't know how to do any of this, but we need to learn very quickly.
Well, I can see one of the advantages you have, if you will, one of the other advantages is that when we are testing for varroa here, we're looking for a level per so many bees. You're looking for one.
Exactly.
It either is or it isn't, as opposed to, well, there's a little bit. So that makes it simpler on that level.
As scientists or as beekeepers in a world where we've accepted varroa as an inevitability, we really worry about having a precise measurement. We need to be able to do a test on the same colony three times and get the exact same measurement so that we can estimate how many mites there are. And that influences treatment decisions and things like that. In Newfoundland, we need an incredibly sensitive measurement. We need whatever will tell us, you know, the first mite that we can possibly detect. And it doesn't matter if there's one, two, or three there. We just want to get those mites as quickly as possible so that we know that we need to activate whatever response mechanisms, you know, can be put into place.
Well, it sounds like a big job, actually, all things considered, getting people trained to do this, and then getting people to do this, and then having them continue to do it. I would guess that's probably going to be an even bigger challenge. Is, yeah, you got to test once a month, or you have to, you know, whatever. Beekeepers in the U.S. are not really good at this anymore, and we've kind of learned to live with it. Yep, I got them. I'm assuming that I have them, and I'm going to do something, as opposed to monitoring the levels of infestation that we have. Jeff, do you see any parallels on this program that we could use on the hornet you have in your part of the world or the pests that we've talked about with Dr. Ramsey?
Yeah. Well, so the Asian giant hornet, it's over in the BC area from a Canadian standpoint in the northern West Washington, where I am. I could see where I like the Sentinel aspects of the plan. I like the early warning, and I like the response plans that are built in place. And I think that's really helpful and really useful. One of the aspects of your plan I liked was you identified probable corridors of where the varroa would transfer, and being as detailed to identify those up front, I think will serve you well. Hopefully not, but it will serve you well if and when that time comes. So with Asian giant hornet, I think that would be aspects of your plan would be really helpful. But I think for everyone, and based on our conversations with Dr. Sam Ramsey on the tropolalapse mite and his concern that if it was to make a foothold in the United States or North America in total, your plan that you've really that you've put a lot of effort into would be a fantastic model and response for the tropolalapse.
Well, we would hope so. And if you'll give me a moment, I'll tell a story that I think illustrates a component of that point there. which is that the way that I first met Peter and got involved in this Newfoundland project is that he read a paper that I wrote on the plausibility of varroa mite transmission at flowers. And so for years, since well before varroa had arrived in the United States, folks had been talking about, well, we know that bees can carry it hive to hive, and we know that there's drifting, and we know that there's robbing, and we know that beekeepers, with our messy habits, might move comb from here to there and wind up spreading the mites. But people had always said, it seems like, plausibly, the mites could also be spreading from bee to bee out of flower. And no one had ever bothered to test that. And so, or at least not in a real rigorous way. And so I decided that one of the first projects of bee science that I pursued in my PhD was precisely that, was to test whether or not you put a mite on a flower, a bee might visit that flower and wind up getting infested, whether it's even plausible that, that could happen. And so Peter found that paper that we eventually published and contacted me, and that's how I got involved. But I set out to do that project with my advisor, Tom Seeley. And he said to me, you know, I think this will be an interesting project. It'll be a fun field research trip, but I doubt we're going to see this because I don't think these eyeless parasites are going to be good at finding a bee and jumping on while she's only briefly drinking nectar from a flower. And I turned to him very sternly and I said, Tom, never underestimate a parasite. And we went out there, and what we saw was that in fact, almost every mite we put on a flower in our little experimental setup wound up jumping onto a forager and riding her back towards the colony. And so I showed that plausibility, but I also really, I showed Tom, even a very long-time beekeeper, that looking at a parasite as a disgusting little pest that you need to get just the right chemical to kill is always going to be a losing strategy. You have to assume that evolution has finely tuned these organisms to doing whatever you least want them to do so that they can succeed. And so the Varroa Action Plan has as its goal, of course, to keep Newfoundland permanently free of varroa or even from a varroa incursion. But we assume that the parasites will find a way, that varroa will eventually find its way onto Newfoundland. And so in addition to all of the monitoring and the assessment and the education and trying to avoid that, you're exactly right. You need to prepare for the worst while also hoping for the best and preparing for the best. Yeah. You have to prepare for everything. It's constant sustained effort. But that's really going to be the only hope. And what we've learned over and over looking at the other countries in the world or regions in the world that have been varroa-free, identified themselves as varroa-free, hoped they would stay varroa-free, and then wound up not varroa-free, is that half measures and planning to have a plan is never enough. You need to be ready, you need to be active, you need to be looking, and you need to know what you'll do when you find that very first mite. Because if you don't, if you aren't, if you just have planned to make a plan in the future, the varroa is going to beat you at every turn.
Yeah. Planning to make a plan is not a plan.
Precisely.
Well, how are you, you know, the next question is then how is this being funded? I mean, this isn't going to be free. A lot of it's going to be volunteer. A lot of it's going to be because of good training, but somebody's going to be doing the training and somebody's going to be doing, measuring the, you know, analyzing the results of samples and things. So where does your government stand in helping fund this?
To date, a lot of the effort here has been volunteer and David Peck has been extremely generous with his time. I have donated my time, so has Steve Walsh. We've received some funding from the provincial government for the workshops, and they are able to provide additional funds for the purchase of monitoring equipment like screen bottom boards for education and so on. We're starting with implementation of the plan this coming weekend with the provincial bee inspectors, Fletcher and Mary Colpitz from New Brunswick, are going to be introducing our beekeepers to the monitoring methods that we think are best practices, the testing methods, the alcohol wash, sugar shake, and screen bottom board. So we're going to use a train-the-trainer model and hope that the people who are trained by the Colpitz from New Brunswick can then go on and train other beekeepers here. So this is being funded by the provincial government. But we note that our province is not well off financially. We have major fiscal challenges here. So a lot of this, I think, is going to depend on the volunteer efforts of our beekeepers. We are going to have to be very independently minded here. And as David has suggested, this is a long-term commitment, and it's going to take discipline and so on. And I hope we're up for it. Our beekeepers are proud of their royalty status, but this none of this comes for free. It's going to take a big effort, I think, and time will tell if we can pull it off.
And the real tragedy of trying to implement a plan like this is that I've studied Varroa for years. I'm a beekeeper. I have Varroa in my colonies, and so I know the devastation that it can cause. Kim, you're a beekeeper. Jeff, you're a beekeeper. You know how bad Varroa can be, and you've experienced the heartbreak of having a nice, strong, healthy colony and then slightly mismanaging your Varroa control and watching them peter out and die in the fall before you even get to see if they make it through the winter. And so the real unfortunate thing, the tragic irony, is that Peter is the person here who needs to drive this plan forward, who needs to motivate the Newfoundland beekeepers, but none of them, unless they've beekept away from Newfoundland, have any idea what's coming. They don't know what Varroa is. They haven't experienced that personal tragedy of losing a hive to mites. And so we need to find a way to educate. And, you know, you don't want to be a fearmonger, but you sort of have to put the fear of God in them. You've got to say, look, your beekeeping might be hard because it's cold, and it might be hard because you don't have quite as many nukes available, but it's going to get a lot harder if you aren't dedicated to keeping these parasites out, because the last thing you need in a marginal beekeeping environment is another challenge for you and your bees to have to overcome.
That's for sure.
Well, it sounds like you got a good start. I'm impressed. It's going to take a lot of coordination, communication, and cooperation to make it work. But I tell you, if I was living up there, I'd be first in line to make sure that I didn't get this beast, because I do know what it's like. Mm-hmm. So I guess I wish him the best, Jeff.
Yeah, I think it's a great undertaking.
Yep. Yeah. I hope it works.
I know we have cheerleaders elsewhere in the world who are wishing us the best. We've had contact with many of our friends in the United States and Australia, New Zealand, the Isle of Man, and elsewhere. And they hope that we can stay, why wouldn't you? They hope that we can stay Varroa free for eternity. But I've encountered a lot of pessimism as well. Pretty much everyone says it's just a matter of time before you get it. So you need to prepare for it and make sure your beekeepers know how to treat now in order to limit the devastation when we finally get it.
Yeah. Realism. It's the hardest part of this.
I like the plan. I encourage everybody to go out there and take a look at the plan. It's well thought out, and can serve for a model for not only for Varroa, but the Asian giant hornet, Tropha laelaps. I like it from just about anything that can attack anything. I think I like the action plan. It's very good. Well done, yep. Guys. Kudos
well done
to you.
Thank you.
Anything else, Jeff?
No, guys, is there anything we haven't, I mean, we could go into great detail, but anything that you want to touch on that we haven't brought up?
If anybody from Newfoundland contacts you and says that they'd like you to ship them a nuke clandestinely, say no.
You got that.
The rest of you can help us by not facilitating illegal importation. So that would really help a lot. And
All right, everybody listening out there, don't send your bees to Newfoundland. They don't want them. Well, David and Peter, thank you very much. This has been very enlightening.
Very good.
Finding your action plan, reading through it, made this simpler to understand. And I encourage everybody to take a look, because we've got some pests on the horizon that we're going to have to be looking for also, and this is a good place to start. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thanks for joining us.
Yep.
Pleasure.
I have to agree with you, Kim, after listening to David and Peter, that it sounds like beekeeping in Newfoundland is very difficult. I'm not sure if I'm hardy enough to even try it, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not trying to make a living up there, but I tell you what they've got going, this program. I haven't heard anything this good on any other pest moving that's migrating into new areas. And you've got one in your backyard, of course, as that the murder hornet coming south from Canada. But this is, they've got an education program, they got surveillance colonies set up, and they've got response to anything that they find that shouldn't be there. And they sound like they're ready to make this work.
Yeah, I'm really impressed by the detail and the depth that they went into to protect their natural resources and their honeybees. I'm really impressed.
And of course they've got the natural barriers. They got, you know, 60 miles of water between them and mainland, and 20 miles between them and the nearest island. So the chances of them getting it accidentally are almost zero. The chances of them getting it illegally, however, is what they're trying to get prepared for.
Yeah, more than likely, as we've seen, that's how things usually get introduced.
Exactly. You know, I wish them luck. It'd be good to have a place in the world besides Australia that doesn't have varroa and be able to have a source of bees that have not been exposed to varroa. Like I said, I really wish them good luck.
Yeah, me too. Well, that about wraps it up for this podcast. Before we go, I want to encourage our listeners to rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, wherever you download and stream the show. Your vote helps other beekeepers find us quicker. Even better, write a review and let other beekeepers looking for a new podcast know what you like. As always, we thank Bee Culture, the magazine for American beekeeping, for their continued support of Beekeeping Today podcast. We want to thank our regular episode sponsor, Global Patties. Check them out at www.globalpatties.com. We also want to thank Strong Microbials for becoming the latest supporter of the podcast. Check out their probiotic line at www.strongmicrobials.com. And finally, we want to thank you, the Beekeeping Today podcast listener, for joining us on this show. Feel free to send us questions or comments, or even verbal questions and comments at questions@beekeepingtodaypodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. Anything else you want to mention, Kim?
Just one thing about the new webpage, Jeff, and that's on the new webpage, the comments that people have left for us previous to now are readily visible. So take a look, see what people are saying about what we do and how we do it. I think you'll be impressed.
Yeah, you bet, and really looking forward to hearing from folks. All right, take care, everybody.
Take care.